Chapter 36. The pilot lined up the Destiny Enterprises company jet for his approach and settled down on the long ice runway without the slightest hint of a bump. The plane, the last one of the fleet that had been sold off, was a custom-built Japanese Dragonfire twin-engine jet with no markings or identification numbers on its fuselage, wings, or tail. It was painted white and blended in with the snowy landscape as it taxied toward what looked like a steep cliff against a high mountain covered with ice. When the aircraft was less than 200 yards from smashing into the mountain, the ice cliff miraculously parted, revealing a vast, grotto-like interior. The pilot slowly pulled back on the throttles, bringing the jet to a stop in the middle of the hangar, which slave labor had carved out of the mountain nearly 60 years earlier. The jet engines whined briefly before their turbines decreased their rotation and slowly came to a quiet rest. Behind, the ponderous ice doors closed on a series of solid rubber wheels. There were two other aircraft parked in the hangar, both Airbus Industry military versions of the A340-300. One was capable of carrying 295 passengers and 20 tons of freight. The other had been built purely as a cargo carrier. Both had maintenance men checking over the engines and filling the fuel tanks for the coming evacuation of Wolf personnel to the safety of the big superships waiting within the safety of the Chilean fjord. The great hangar was a beehive of quiet activity. Workers in the various Wolf-colored uniforms moved silently, conversing softly, as they packed the 100 or more wooden crates with the artifacts and wealth of Amenes, along with the looted art treasures from World War II and the sacred Nazi relics, all being readied for transportation to the Ulrich Wolf. 50 men in the standard Destiny Enterprises black security uniform stood at attention as Carl Wolf, along with his sister Elsie, exited the aircraft. He was wearing alpine ski pants and a big suede jacket lined with alpaca wool. Elsie was dressed in a one-piece ski suit under a knee-length fur coat. The man who directed the transportation project waited at the bottom of the boarding steps as they stepped to the ground. "Cousin Carl, Cousin Elsie, you do us an honor by coming."
"Cousin Horst," Carl greeted him. "I felt it my duty to observe the Doomsday system in its final stages."
"An hour that is near at hand," Elsie added proudly.
"How goes the evacuation?" asked Carl.
"Cargo and passengers are scheduled to arrive on the Ulrich Wolf 10 hours before the cataclysm," Horst assured him.
Then their brother Hugo and sister Blondie stepped forward to greet them. They took turns embracing.
"Welcome back to Valhalla," Blondie greeted Carl.
"Other business has kept me away too long," said Carl.
Hugo, who was the chief of the family security force, gestured toward a small electric automobile, one of a fleet of utility and heavy equipment vehicles that ran on batteries, to prevent a buildup of carbon monoxide inside the caverns.
"We'll take you to the control center, where you can see for yourself how we begin the end of the old world."
"After I inspect your guards," said Carl.
Trailed by Elsie, he walked down the line of security guards in their black uniforms, who stood ramrod straight, with their P-10 automatics strapped to their hips and Bushmaster M-17S rifles slung over their shoulders. He stopped occasionally and asked a guard his nationality and military history. When he reached the end of the line, he nodded in satisfaction.
"An intrepid company of men. You've done well, Hugo. They look like they can handle any intrusion."
"Their orders are to shoot to kill any unidentified intruder that enters our perimeter. I hope they perform with greater efficiency than Eric's men at the shipyard."
"There will be no failure at this end," Hugo said firmly. "I promise you, brother."
"Any sign of encroachment?" "None," answered Blondie. "Our detection control unit has seen no activity within 150 miles of the facility."
Elsie looked at her.
150 miles does not seem far."
It's the distance to Little America Number 6, the Yankee Antarctic Research Station. Since the station was built, they've shown no interest in our operations. Our aerial surveillance has yet to detect any attempt to trespass onto our mining facility. All is quiet with the Americans, added Hugo. They'll give us no problems.
I'm not so sure, said Carl.
Keep a tight eye on any activity. I fear their intelligence may be on the verge of discovering our secret.
Any attempt to stop us, Hugo said confidently, will come too late. The Fourth Empire is inevitable.
I sincerely pray that will be the case, said Carl, as he entered the auto ahead of the women.
Usually gallant around the ladies, Carl came from the old German school where men never yielded to women. The driver of the electric car left the aircraft hangar area and entered a tunnel. After a quarter of a mile, they entered a vast ice cavern that enclosed a small harbor with long floating docks that rose and fell with the tide from the Ross Sea. The high-roofed channel that ran from the inner harbor to the sea curved gently, allowing large ships to navigate the passage while the ice cliffs blocked all view from the outside. Light throughout the complex came from overhead fixtures containing dozens of halogen bulbs. Four submarines and a small cargo ship were moored beside the docks. The entire harbor complex was deserted. The cargo cranes stood abandoned, along with a small fleet of trucks and equipment. There wasn't a soul to be seen on the docks or the vessels. It was as if their crews had walked off and never returned.
A pity the U-boats that served our venture so efficiently all these years will be lost, said Elsie wistfully.
Perhaps they will survive, Blondie consoled her.
Hugo smiled.
When the time comes, I will personally return to Valhalla to see how they fared. They deserve to be enshrined for their service to the Fourth Empire.
The old tunnel that ran 9 miles through the ice between the hidden dock terminal, the aircraft hangar, and then to the sea mining extraction facility, had also been excavated by slaves from the old Soviet Union, their preserved bodies now frozen in a mass grave on the ice shelf. Since 1985, the tunnel had been expanded and constantly realigned because of the shifting ice. In the beginning, the efforts to extract valuable minerals from the sea had proven a dismal failure. But with the nanotechnology revolution pioneered by Eric Drexler in California, along with his wife, Chris Peterson, Destiny Enterprises had thrown its immense wealth and resources into a project to control the structure of matter. By rearranging atoms and creating incredibly tiny engines, they had totally reinvented manufacturing processes. Molecular machines could even produce a tree from scratch. The Wolfs, however, threw their efforts into extracting valuable minerals such as gold from seawater, a process they'd achieved and gone on to refine, until they were producing 1,000 troy ounces of gold a day from the Ross Sea, along with platinum, silver, and many other rare elements. Unlike ore pulled from the ground and then expensively processed by crushers and chemicals, the minerals extracted from the sea came in a nearly pure form. The engineering center of the Destiny Enterprises sea mining facility was a great domed structure whose interior looked similar to the vast control room at the NASA Space Center. Electronic consoles were manned by 30 scientists and engineers who monitored the computerized electronics of the nanotech mining operation. But this day, all operations for the extraction of rare metals from the sea had come to a halt, and all Wolf personnel were concentrating their efforts on the coming split of the ice shelf. Carl Wolf entered the expansive room and stopped in front of a spacious electronic board that hung from the center of the domed ceiling. In the center, a large map of the Ross ice shelf was displayed. Around the edges, a series of neon-like tubing distinguished the ice from the surrounding land. The tubing, which stretched from the mining company around the ice shelf and ended 300 miles from the opposite end, was green.
The section from where the green ended was continued in red to the edge of the sea. "The area in red is yet to be programmed," Carl asked the chief engineer, Jürgen Holtz, who walked up to the Wolf party and gave a sharp nod of his head in greeting.
"Yes, that is correct."
Holtz raised a hand and gestured at the board.
"We are in the process of setting the molecular triggering devices. We have about another 400 miles to program to the end of the tunnel at the sea."
Carl studied the constantly changing red letters and numbers on the digital displays spaced around the map.
"When is the critical moment?"
"The final process for splitting off the ice shelf is timed for 6 hours." Holtz paused to stare up at a series of numbers showing the time left until doomsday. 22 minutes and 40 seconds from now."
"Any problems that might cause a delay?"
"None we are aware of. All computerized procedures and their backup systems have been inspected and scrutinized dozens of times. We have yet to find the slightest hint of a possible malfunction."
"An amazing feat of engineering," Carl said quietly, while gazing at the colored tubing surrounding the ice shelf.
"A pity the world will never know of its existence."
"An amazing feat indeed," echoed Holtz, "boring a 10-foot diameter tunnel 1,400 miles through the ice in 2 months."
"The credit goes to you and your engineers who designed and built the molecular tunneling machine," said Elsie, pointing at a large photo on one wall. The picture showed a 100-foot-long circular boring machine with a thrust ram, debris conveyor, and a strange-looking unit on the front that pulled apart selected molecular bonds within the ice, producing powder snow-sized chunks small enough to be transported to the rear of the conveyors to the open sea. A secondary unit rebonded the tiny chunks into near-perfect crystalline solid ice that was used to line the tunnel. When in full operation, the tunneler could bore through 50 miles of ice in 24 hours. Having accomplished its purpose, the great machine now sat under a growing sheet of ice outside the mining facility.
"Perhaps after the ice melts, we'll have an opportunity to use the tunneler again on subterranean rock," Carl said thoughtfully.
"You think the ice will melt away?" asked Elsie, puzzled.
"If our calculations are 95% correct, this section of the Antarctic will end up 1,800 miles north of here 2 months after the cataclysm."
"I've never quite understood how all this is going to break off the entire ice shelf and send it out to sea," said Elsie.
Carl smiled.
"I'd forgotten that you were the family intelligence collector in Washington for the past 3 years and were not provided with details of the Valhalla project." Holtz held up one hand and pointed to the giant display board.
"As simply as I can explain it, Miss Wolf, our nano-computerized machine constructed a vast number of molecular replicating assemblers, which in turn constructed many millions of tiny molecular ice-dissolving machines."
Elsie looked pensive.
"In other words, the replicated assemblers, through molecular engineering, can create machines that can produce most anything."
"That's the beauty of nanotechnology," replied Holtz. "The replicating assembler can copy itself in a few minutes. In less than 24 hours, tons of replicated machines, moving trillions of atoms around, drilled holes into the ice every 6 inches above and below the tunnel. Once the ice tubes were drilled to a preconceived depth, the nanocomputer closed down all further instructions to the machines. In 16 hours, the moment our meteorologists have predicted a strong offshore wind in combination with a favorable current, a signal will be sent to reactivate the machines. They will then finish the job of dissolving the ice and separating the shelf from the continent, allowing it to drift out to sea."
"How long will that take?" asked Elsie.
"Less than 2 hours," answered Holtz.
"Then, 10 hours after the final break," Carl explained, "the displaced weight of the Ross ice shelf will have moved far enough away from the Antarctic continent to throw off Earth's delicately balanced rotation, just enough to cause a polar shift in unison with a crust displacement, sending the world into a devastating upheaval."
"A world which we then can reshape into our image,"
said Elsie vaingloriously. A man in the black uniform of a security guard came rushing out of an office and approached the group.
"Sir,"
he said to Carl, handing him a sheet of paper. Carl's face darkened for a brief instant before turning reflective.
"What is it?" Elsie asked.
"A report from Hugo," Carl answered slowly. "It seems an unidentified aircraft is approaching from across the Amundsen Sea and refuses to answer our signals." "Probably the supply plane for the ice station at Little America," said Holtz. "Nothing to be concerned about. It flies in and out every 10 days.
"Does it always pass over Valhalla?" asked Carl.
"Not directly, but it comes within a few miles as it makes its descent toward the ice station." Carl turned to the security guard who had carried the message. "Please tell my brother to observe the approaching aircraft closely. If it deviates from its normal flight path to Little America, have him notify me immediately."
"Are you troubled, brother?" asked Elsie.
Carl looked at her, his face showing traces of concern.
"Not troubled, my sister, merely cautious. I do not trust the Americans."
"The United States is a long way away," said Elsie. "It would take an American assault force more than 24 hours to assemble and fly over 10,000 miles to Okuma Bay."
"Still," Carl said patiently, "it pays to be vigilant." He looked at Holtz. "Should a distraction arise, can the signal to split the ice be sent early?"
"Not if we want absolute success," Holtz replied firmly. "Timing is critical. We must wait until just before the peak of the flood tide to activate the molecular ice dissolving machines. Then the ebb tide will carry the great mass of the ice shelf out to sea."
"Then it appears we have nothing to fear," said Elsie optimistically.
Carl dropped his voice, speaking slowly, softly.
"I hope you're right, dear sister."
At that moment, another security guard approached and passed Carl a message from Hugo. He read it, looked up, and smiled faintly.
"Hugo says the American supply plane is on its normal course 10 miles beyond our perimeter and is flying at an altitude of 35,000 feet.
"Hardly the height to drop an assault team," said Holtz.
"No nation on Earth would dare fire missiles into our facility without their intelligence agencies penetrating our operation. And none have. Hugo's security force has diverted and blocked all outside probes into Valhalla."
"Diverted and blocked," Carl repeated. But his mind was not so sure. He recalled one man who had already defied too many of the Wolf's family aims, and Carl could not but wonder where he might be.